I'm Darius Larson, the village philosopher here through Saturday, campus pastor at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And tonight's forum topic is militarism, the American way, question mark or exclamation mark. How I'd like to at least start the focus is by sharing with you a card. I don't have the cartoon here, but it's in the Albuquerque Journal that had the sign, the welfare state, and scratched out the EL and added the AR, the warfare state. That are we really, in essence, moving away from a welfare state society to a warfare state society, and what are the ramifications of that? And in order to kind of set the stage, I wanted to share with you different editorials. Most of them have come from the National Catholic Reporter to kind of just set the stage for us to get into this discussion. The first one is an editorial from the National Catholic Reporter. We arm and it is for deterrence sake or to gain bargaining chips at the negotiating table. They arm and it is part of their militaristic plans for world domination. We send military advisors and troops into foreign lands, and it is to support beleaguered governments. They send advisors and troops into foreign lands, and it is to stir up trouble and expand their military influence. We offer a proposal at the negotiating table, and it is in good faith. They offer a proposal, and it is a political ploy to win favorable world opinion. The U.S. plans to spend $45 billion in the next 6 years preparing for nuclear war, approximately 22% of all military spending. Spending on nuclear weapons has more than doubled since President Reagan became president. And then another one entitled U.S. Primary Export is Militarism, he states, the escalation in the purchase of arms, especially by Third World, continues to be amazing and frightening. In the last 8 years, the transfer of arms came to $236 billion. The United States continues to be the top seller. In 1982, the U.S. reached a record high in sales to Third World of $15.3 billion. In 1981, the U.S. government sold arms to 96 nations. During those years, 1974 to 82, 45% of all the major weapons purchased by the Third World were purchased through the United States. 27.5% of these exports originated in the Soviet Union, with 90% of all the Soviet sales going to the Arab world. The two superpowers have been so aggressive in trying to turn Third World nations into client states that it is no longer possible for these countries to distinguish between their own security interests and those of the United States and the USSR. The world's average annual expenditure per soldier is $19,300. It is $52,800 in the United States. The average spend each year in education for a child is $380 worldwide, $563 in the United States. And if my math is right, the difference between per soldier worldwide and the United States is 160% roughly, and the difference between per child of worldwide and the United States in education is about 70%. And so there's an increase there by quite a substantial amount. There are 556 soldiers, but only 85 doctors per 100,000 persons in the Third World. The United States, which seeks to militarize countries to make them or confirm them as clients of the United States, pursuing the containment of communism as their predominant or even their only objective of U.S. foreign policy. So goes those. Interesting article, I won't read it, but just talking about the similarity between militarism and racism, they stem from the same fault. Stating that racism says that whites are superior to blacks, militarism says we are superior to our country's enemies, and it lists a bunch of other parallels. Two other qu- quick ones here. Militarism eats away at humanistic values praised by Americans. And an analysis of 11 widely used junior high and senior high texts by researchers for the Bulletin of the Council on Interracial Books for Children illustrated the subtlety of militaristic indoctrination. None of the books, quote, raised philosophical questions about the acceptability of war or made any effort to show the extent of human suffering. On the other hand, while the text did not glamorize war per se, it was nevertheless glamorized in, quote, the detail given to military strategy, in the adjectives used to describe particular wars, and in the ways U.S. war leaders are extolled. War leaders and wars are referred to as with value-laden terms, such as heroic, courageous, and terrific. 10 of the 11 history books dismiss the effects of the bombings of Hiroshima or Nagasaki in two sentences or less. 5 do have pictured illustrations, but they show no people. None of the 11 disputes the standard President Harry Truman's argument that the atom bomb saved many American lives, and so forth and so forth. Also, it was interesting that we stayed on our way out here in Missoula with a friend of ours, and son was 8 years old, and he brought down to Christopher all of his G.I. Joe collections. And he said, this with just utter seriousness, G.I. Joe, the great American hero. And where does that come from, I may ask. And the American Society, has taken to heart the lessons of the Great Society and declared war on the poverty-stricken and every class that falls below the Neiman-Marcus line of credit. And in the free fire opportunity zone, the unemployment simply ceased to figure in at all. National security demands sacrifice, namely the sacrifice of Social Security, of domestic peace and well-being. The U.S. is heading for war. The best test of it is its credibility this time, is the war it is waging at home. Now, all of that says that militarism is alive and well and living in the United States. The other side of the argument is that without it, this would be a very insecure world. Without it, we would be taken over very quickly by the Soviets, and therefore we need to export ammunition, guns, bombs, and everything else. And there is to really throw us to a loop. George Will, who writes in Newsweek, wrote an article, Why Arms Control is Harmful. Don't want to precise to get into the arms control debate, but to show you that there's another side to confuse the issue just a bit here, says that the idea of the arms race, often described as spiraling, I can't talk tonight, is odd. The U.S. nuclear weapons inventory has been sharply reduced. It contains 8,000 fewer warheads and 25% less megatons than in the 1960s. This is the result not of arms agreement, but of modernization programs that produce safer, more effective weapons. Modernization of the sort that arms control advocates try to block with agreements. And then he just concludes, for that reason, someone should tell Ronald Reagan to quit saying that nothing is more important than development of a better working relationship with the Soviet Union. Such talk worsens the U.S.-Soviet negotiations by building pressure on the U.S. government for concessions to produce movement. And he says that we should not be about that. So, that's enough background, maybe too much, a lot of figures in there and things, but the issue that I would like to see how you feel about today is, can we take it for granted that we are becoming a militarized state, and if not, why not? And if we have become that way, is that good and is that necessary? And to what cost, moving into the welfare state stuff. So Any other comments, any questions, any statements? The rest of the 45 minutes are open to the floor.
I think there's no question that we're becoming, or we're not becoming, we are. We have been a militaristic state, we've been a militaristic economy since 1945, but there are zillions of ramifications of that. I think the scariest thing is the paranoia, the subtle, and not so subtle paranoia, that the Ruskies are going to come over and attack us any day now. That whole thing just kind of invades our thinking. It is a poison. It poisons our lives in ways that we don't even realize.
Is it a grounded paranoia?
A what paranoia?
A grounded one? Does it have justification, or is it just far-fetched?
Well, I think I wouldn't go as far as say it's not at all that. Certainly, we live in a volatile world, but it's escalated beyond proportions that we can deal with. I mean, there are lots of people that I know who refuse to think about the issues because they think there's nothing they can do about it. And if there's nothing you can do about it, then you just kind of live in this poison that swells. And it's not good for people, it's not good for the country, it's not good for business, it's not good for any of us. And I honestly don't think it'll help us one bit if, a war comes about. I mean, it's just useless stirring. It kind of seeps into every part of our society.
Some other comments.
How do we deal with an atheistic power? One that says that they are determined to take over the world. They've said it. You have to take a man for what he says. And they say this.
Okay, how do we deal with that?
Khrushchev is no longer leader any more there than Ike Eisenhower is here. So I can't say that their policies are static. The second thing is that because a government is atheist does not mean that the country is atheist. There are many Christians who live in Russia. They have to live underground. They have to worship in a situation that we do not envy by any means. But our Constitution was not written by Christians, and this is not a Christian country either. This is a country that has lots of Christians who are free to worship in, but this is not a Christian country, nor is their country atheist. It's a country that has probably fewer Christians that are under a bondage of no freedom of religion. But when we talk about killing Russians, we're killing Christians.
How many Christians? Chuck Lutz has the answer here.
Well, the estimate. You just asked me how many are there. The estimates that you could see vary from 60 to 100 million. Orthodox being the largest number. There are a couple million Lutherans. There are a couple million Baptists. There are, I think, about 5 or 6 million Roman Catholics. So there are about 25 or 30 million Muslims in the Soviet Union who are believers.
Does it matter if we kill Christians or un-Christians?
No.
People. I think Christians fight wars too.
Why do you say the Constitution was not written by Christians?
Because they weren't. Thomas Jefferson was a Christian.
That's right. He was not recognized as a Christian denomination.
He was a deist.
But good background point, but let's not lose the point of the night. In regards, and we have to deal with our history, we have to deal with other world powers in dealing with the key question of, is militarism necessary and or healthy for us in today's world? And at what cost? When is enough enough, I would think? How much do we need? You know, in one sense, I think these articles were saying, we are in a state of war because we have to continue to put all of our human resources into building these defense mechanisms to the extent that now we are pulling back in almost every other welfare social service agency. And is that what we need to do in order to protect ourselves from whatever it is that we need to protect ourselves from?
I think we need to ask the question, is the danger real? Because he said business was not good, but business is excellent. The worker business is doing very well. And I don't think that we can, I don't know, but I just question whether the Russians are as dangerous or if we're not as dangerous as they are in some cases.
Well, we haven't. We are not taking over other countries.
Okay, let's because when hands start going up and stuff, I have hands and I'll try to call. Yeah, there and then over here.
I think one of the main issues that's probably going to come up tonight is the significant difference in the perceptions of what is going on based on generations. Not that there aren't agreements, but I've been working with adolescents for the last 13 years in education, and I used to take it for granted that it was just talk that these young people were really greatly frightened by nuclear war, and that anxiety created hopelessness, lack of goal setting, to be really specific, that they just said, what's the use? I used to kind of laugh at that and say, oh, that's nonsense, until I began to deal directly with that issue and found out that, in fact, above the concerns of peer pressure, like dating or just being cared for by their friends, that they actually did have that sense of fear, of hopelessness, and that it is, in fact, affecting them very differently than my generation. I was a post-war baby. And then my father's generation had a very different perception of those kind of issues. I think that it's not ignorance that creates the difference in opinion here and all the other circles. It's background. I don't think that it's hard to grab a hold of facts, I guess, is what I'm saying. Our backgrounds, the experiences we have are very much painted. The feelings that we have now, feel very strongly about. I hear patriotic talk over here, and yet you hear almost a violent eruption of anxiety and say, oh yes, we are, and look at there's a generation difference in, it's just background.
Another good discussion is, could both be considered patriotic talk? You know, that would be nice. Over here.
Well, to answer the question, you asked, is militarism the answer to the world problems? In a lot of cases, I don't believe it's the answer, especially in the present administration. Because, for one thing, I'll be more specific later, but for one thing, the Reagan administration tends to meet force with force. But that's obviously a good excuse to the other power, Russia, to build up their weapons. It just gives them a good excuse to do that. Now, narrowing down to Africa, look at Angola. The U.S. supported MPLA, but I don't doubt that the U.S. knew which side was supported by the majority of the people. But because MPLA was pro-capitalistic in some ways, they supported it against the will of the majority of the people, and they lost, naturally. And now they blame communism over the interests of the people. The same thing is happening in South Africa. The Reagan administration is supporting South Africa. And they are saying, they're taking the propaganda from the South African government that they are communists, the communist threat in Southern Africa. But the Southern government doesn't say is that these so-called terrorists or communists are black African citizens who had to leave the country in 1976, students expelled by the government force. And in the 60s, members of the ANC, which was a non-violent liberation movement, willing to talk with the government, and those were forced to leave the country. And so they resorted to arms. But now, The U.S. government says, takes that and says, well, indeed there is a communist threat in Southern Africa. And they don't look at the black people who are suffering and say, why is there such a situation? And they know full well that there are no communists, especially in South Africa. They may be using communist ways because they're supported by communists, but that doesn't mean they're just South African citizens who are trying to find ways of solution. So I don't think it solves the problem to be militaristic.
Yeah. In fact, that indignant answer when I said the United States didn't take over. What happened at war with Japan? Did we take over Japan when we won the war? Same thing in Europe and World War II. What countries did we take over?
We, in a sense, did take over.
We did, huh?
By doing what we're doing in defense in Germany and so forth, we are occupying that country still today, in a sense, with our armed forces. And there are many people over in Germany that don't particularly like this. But I think the best example of why we are a warfare state is Grenada. Then the president gets on the air with a melodramatic statement saying, and we got there just in time. The thing that surprised me is that nobody really objects to what we did there.
Nobody in the United States.
Yes.
Okay. Somebody else has a question?
Have you been to Grenada? Do they object there?
Pardon?
Say, have you been to Grenada so you know what the people in Grenada feel about it? Well, it's rather ridiculous to make
The question may be, to what extent do we have to, not whether or not we should arm or disarm or all of that, the question is, how much arms should we continue to build for our own defense? How much should we continue to export for other people and to sell to sometimes somewhat hostile people? And then the third, to what expense? Because, you know, there's this so-called recession that's been happening, has been happening in every area but our national defense buildup. And so that we have been funneling more money that direction. And I'm not saying it's wrong. My question is I'm wondering if that's wrong or have we gone too far, the state of health, education, welfare, and other programs?
Yes, to answer the question, you were saying, did we take over any country that is America? In a sense, I would say you didn't take over any country, but you have your influence in Japan, as you mentioned. And so this is a natural consequence, you know. Like,
yes,
in Russia.
But the Japanese have to make, they're the ones that make the decision whether they want to do anything with,
yes,
the United States.
I'm getting to the difference. You see, the Russian government is not very successful economically. And for that reason, it has to use suppression to keep the countries it has had influence over. But America, you have to notice that America is very welcome to most countries in the world. For instance, in my country, if we became free and we knew we were helped by America, we would welcome America to be present.
His country is South Africa, that, for those,
yes,
who don't know.
That wouldn't mean you are taking over, but you would be present in the influence. And then the Russians would say, look at America, it's taken over there. Because the America would have influence. And if you see Russia having influence over other countries, then you have the right to say Russia has taken over that country.
Thank you. I want to add to that to some extent that NATO, for instance, partially on the basis of European nations voluntarily doing this, has been, since the close of World War II, we have been the defenders of all of Europe. Now, being in the position as their, almost the entirety of their defense, means that we have an awful lot of clout over NATO nations. It's not always been rosy, but I'd like to point out that the Eastern Bloc nations under the Russians, who have a not similar but not entirely dissimilar relationship with the Eastern Bloc nations haven't always had it so rosy either. Czechoslovakia and Poland have been trying to break out of things, not Poland by their government, but by their people. And so what does the Russians do when one of their influenced nations attempts to do something different? When the labor movement starts to go and get strength in Poland, they have military exercises on the border of Poland. What do we do when Nicaragua is threatening to have changes that we don't like? We have military exercises in their neighboring country with thousands of men. The difference is very slim that I can see, that you're threatening on one side, the Russians are threatening Poland and saying, you guys shape up, be a good member of the communist bloc, or else. And we're saying to the Central American nations that we're doing the same thing to, you guys shape up, be good banana growers for us, and don't get any ideas about being independent economically, or else. It's the same message, relayed by the same technique, military exercises. But when we do it, it's in the name of freedom, and when they do it, it's in the name of the bad guys. We are a better country to live in. I would never hesitate to say that. But we have for too long felt that we've been lily white in the world, and that is not true.
Think this statement is true? Americans, John Kennedy once said, must bear any burden, pay any price for the privilege of keeping the world safe from authoritarian regimes, I guess.
How does America keep the world safe from itself?
Shortly after that, the next president said, we can afford both defense and guns and butter. And then we found out that we really couldn't, and we got this tremendous inflation.
So now we chose guns over butter. Because without guns, we won't have butter, some people would say.
I think Korea is a good example of what I was trying to say about the United States' policy. I was over there a few years ago, and I talked to a lot of Koreans because I had friends who lived in Seoul. And we didn't go into war to stop North Korea from dividing, you know, the country. And some of the South Koreans would like to have had us do it, but they could understand why we didn't. We didn't want to go there.
You had
a
comment?
I was going to say the irony of that whole thing. We always say we're doing this to defend freedom or defend our style of life, our way of life. Now, part of that way of life is our educational system, for one thing, that we brag about. Free education, and basically free type of thing. Mm-hmm. And yet, we spend far more to defend it than we do to support it at this point. Now, that point is a very dangerous thing, in my estimation, as to where that would be going then. Where you start spending more to defend it than you do to enhance it or to make it happen.
I'd like to pull this back to Christianity.
Good. If I may. You're more than welcome to.
Swords to plowshares is an interesting, there's a neat little pin down in the resource center on it. But in some of this discussion a while back on television, on American television, there was a comment that, on the one hand, Jesus said, put your sword away, those that live by the sword will die by the sword. On the other hand, the quotation was made, and I don't know where it is, I don't remember it quite as literally, but you have to sell your coat to buy a sword. Anybody got proof text theology? If you don't have a sword, buy one.
Yeah.
It seems somewhere.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the people of the world have never tried Christ's way. They've never tried buying freedom by going to a cross and dying. Okay, maybe they did back in the early days in Rome, when they were fed to the lions and the church expanded and expanded and expanded. But I don't think we've ever taken a shot at that. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about the idea that if we don't have arms, if we don't have tanks, if we don't have American neighbors to protect us for their own self-interest, because we live in a country north of you, and Russia can come easily come across, so they'll protect us. But if we don't have this stuff, we might just die. We might not have freedom. But we still have the promise of God in Jesus Christ. And to me, I think that's the Christian message. Not we're Christian and they're atheist or whatever and so forth. But that's as much a Christian message as a welfare state over against a workers.
To respond to what you were saying, that the world has not tried the Christian method, I don't know on what scale you mean the Christian method, but I have a feeling that America itself is a world in its own, and I can say that the American black people, Martin Luther King Jr., has tried the Christian method in that world. And we are in South Africa are trying even today. That's why I'm here and talking. But some of my brothers and sisters have given up the Christian method. But now we have to beat them to the solution before they explode. So I do believe that we are trying the Christian method.
Yeah, I was going to respond to Fred in a similar way. I think within nations, Gandhi would be an example. King would be an example. There have been movements totally dedicated to nonviolence, and that brought about significant change. Unfortunately, there are very few nations in the history of the world that have not had armies. I think the only one in today's world is Costa Rica. Since 1948, Costa Rica, by constitution, has not had a military. And yet today, the United States is pressing Costa Rica to militarize, because Costa Rica borders on Nicaragua. And I think it would be one of the tragedies of our lifetime if that should happen. Not that Costa Rica is going to set the example for any other nations to follow. It hasn't. But I've always found it somewhat satisfying that there's one nation in the 150 or so of the world that doesn't have a military. Costa Rica's it. And it may be about to join the rest of it. But the other thing I wanted to say, Fred, is I think there's a real tension between what individual or groups of Christians may feel called to do, which is to be nonviolent. I think that is the way of Christ. And what leaders of nations feel called to do once they become leaders of nations. Herbert Hoover once said that as a Quaker, which he was, he was committed personally to nonviolence and to the renunciation of the use of force, of armed force. But as Commander-in-Chief of the United States government, and of its armies, therefore, he had no choice but to be the Commander-in-Chief of the armies of the United States. Jesus said, if my followers were of this world, if my kingdom were of this world, my followers would fight. They're not of this world, so they don't fight. The problem is, the United States is a nation of this world. It is not of the other world. I mean, the United States as a nation, as a country, does not see itself as following Jesus Christ, I guess. That's what it comes down to. And I think the Christians in the first three centuries were able to be pacifists until they had to rule, until they had to run into it. And whether they were right or wrong, they then decided, we've got to stop the barbarians, we've got to have an army. And suddenly, overnight, Christians went from not serving in the army to being the leaders of the military. It was almost that rapid. And I think that's the dilemma that political and national leaders always have to deal with. Augustine said, it isn't a matter of choosing to love your neighbor or not love your neighbor, it's which neighbor you're going to love. And he said, for military or for national leadership, they have to choose to love the neighbors who are their own citizens first, against the barbarians or the enemy or whoever. And I don't see any way out of that, I guess, as long as the world is a fallen world. And maybe that's why I don't personally identify as a pacifist, even though I concede that that was Jesus' way, that is Jesus' way. But I think there is that dilemma. I don't know if we could elect to the Congress of the United States anybody who is a pacifist. It hasn't happened for a long, long time. I don't know if anybody running as a pacifist could get elected. Mm-hmm. It'd be an interesting experiment.
Interesting question, too. Yeah.
I think the danger is deluding ourselves into thinking that we really are following Christ's way or the Christian way when we're not.
Exactly.
It seems clear to me that we are not one nation under God that we seem to train our children so carefully to say, but we delude ourselves into thinking that we are, and therein lies the danger.
That's why it's dangerous to say we're a Christian nation, mm-hmm. if that implies that we are following the way of Christ. Mm-hmm. I don't think we are.
There is a very interesting confession of faith in the United States of America that on every greenback that you have, it says in God we trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very. Down here and then up there.
A book that I read this last year, did together with a group of other pastors around our tech study, was by John Paul. And the title is very similar to the one that Elmer Witt wrote a number of years ago, but it has a church of future. I think it's the title of it, anyway, John W. Hall. And it's kind of a mind-blowing book, and his basic thesis is this, that he thinks it is ridiculous for us to ever have believed that Christianity was intended by Jesus to be a controlling group. That when we start doing that, we deny the gospel. That the Christians, the group of followers of Christ, were always to be the minority. That there was never supposed to be, by Jesus' intention, a controlling group. Constantine was the guy who supposedly made Christianity acceptable, but in reality, he absolutely undermined everything that Jesus stood for.
So that was a mistake.
That was a total mistake, an absolute mistake. And that for us to talk in terms of a Christian nation or anything like that, whether you have this kind of a thought in mind, is to maybe completely be working against the Christian faith and the way of Christ. That the Christian is to be always a minority group in the world doing his will, and we will never be using the power or the machinery or the things of the world to complete his kingdom, to work through his kingdom. That is totally impossible. I think that book has got a lot going for it.
It's in the bookstore, then. Yeah. Yeah. Tom?
This is just feedback on that, I guess. I would want to ask the question, if we give up our Christian faith so much when we serve in public office, what business do we have serving in public office, orchestrating the militarism that we're involved in? I think that as you said, we deny our faith, and aside from that, I just think it's uncreative. I'm not sure being in political office is always the only way to change things. But much of the social change in this world has come from the underside, from those minority groups, non-violently. And I think that if we say that our goal is to serve in political office, to begin to control in that way, we really do deny our faith. And we close off some possibilities that I think that are there for us, but we don't realize them. Nonviolent change.
Does that come back? I would add, too, that Christianity can never use power. That seems to be the message of Christ.
Power by this world's power.
This world's power. It cannot use that. And the minute that we become, quote, a Christian nation and start using that, we have not. We cannot.
We shouldn't baptize people at the point of the sword anymore?
Yeah. Only St. Olaf is in trouble.
here, and then here. Okay.
Well, Roger. I have the benefit of reading the book. So I certainly can't claim to critique it. But to me, just the gut reaction is that Jesus does not call us out of the world, though. I mean, the other side of that coin is it sounds like you could go back to a monastic group who is sitting and maybe serving the poor in the local community by going making wine and baking bread and handing it out to the folks that are close by because we're supposed to be a minority. You know, I think, to me, that to the extent, not that it's going to be perfected or that anyone would stay in office, but to the extent that in an office of power, goals consistent with those of Christ, not ideally those of Christ, but consistent with that, has to be a betterment of society. Whether or not we're talking about making it a Christian society or not is something else. But
Chuck's question was that person would probably never be elected. Therefore, there is no such person.
Well, I don't know.
Or is that debatable? I mean, that's what I heard Chuck
say. There are people in Congress who will vote Bread for the World right down the line. Mm-hmm. And there are not very many, but there are a few. And, you know, that
But there aren't any who will vote disarmament, which I regret. But I don't think there's a single member of our Congress who would vote for unilateral disarmament today. And I think that's what following Jesus would call for. I really do. I don't think it's going to happen. I agree with Tom. Every politician compromises. And every Christian in politics compromises. I think that's accurate. But it may also be inevitable.
Probably every Christian outside politics.
I think so.
Okay, let's keep raising because we have one here and then one over here and then one here. So.
I agree that we'll never make this a Christian nation, and we can't use military power to get what we want. We can't use the total power of politics around it or whatever. But I think that that doesn't say we can't, as Christians, try to influence in whatever way we can. If we think our country's going the wrong way, we should do whatever we can to stop it. And that may be very little, but I think that's what we have to do.
Mm-hmm. And the good question might be, what are some of those ways? But so if anybody wants to comment on it.
What she just said about the influence of what the gentleman said about our being a minority, remember that we're told that a little leaven leaveneth the whole. And we read in the Old Testament, you know, that for ten righteous men, the nation will be saved. And I think that's the function, not for us to say that we want to have Congress and the White House made up of Christians. And that's not the objective. The objective is to be the influence, as she says. And that influence then will be a saving grace to the nation. The nations come under judgment just as well as individuals. But it's up to the minority, the Christian minority, to make sure that we are the leaven and we are enough righteous people that we can save the nation.
Is it too black and white to say that if we were the leaven across, we'd be more of a welfare state than a warfare state? Just throw that out to anybody. Do you have a comment over here?
Yeah, well, I was going to address the business and the politicians. They don't probably have the nerve to say that they would rather serve the bread than be in military because of the votes that we will not receive. Because we're in tune to militaryisms. I think some of those men are men who probably down in their hearts would like to help the third world with food and things.
How many of you think the current status of our government with its budgets and its armament and its sales and exports of things are basically we're on the right course? How many think we're on the right course? Okay, a couple people. How many think we're a little bit off course? And then the other one is way off course. How many think we're a little bit off course? Okay, how many think we're way off course? Okay. What would help get us on course, and what is that course? Or those of you who think we're a little bit off course, you know, that answer to how you vote here. 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
Well, I think what will get us on a different course will be a shift in economics or in power systems. What I was thinking a minute ago was I think I really appreciate your comment about being a minority, being sort of an underground movement as a Christian identity, because this is a nation with a lot of wonderful people in it, some of them Christians, the Soviet Union, likewise is a nation with a lot of wonderful people in it, some of them Christians. And I like this system better, but this nation doesn't have any particular righteousness about it. And we kid ourselves when we think it does, and we grow up thinking that. It takes a lot, it's hard to come to recognition that there's nothing particularly righteous about this country. Nor is there anything particularly righteous about our economic system. And so we can't expect righteousness of it, of those systems. Goodness is not going to come forth. Although good people will arise and say good things and act in a way that we respect, and maybe those people will be Christians. But what will change things, I think, is only a power shifting, power bases, and economic incentives. And so the motion, the movement to have our system be more compassionate or kinder or less military, it is going to have to be an entirely underground one, I think.
Okay.
One of the biggest arguments I've heard from people that feel that our militarism is not such a bad thing is, well, take those statistics, look what it's doing for our economy. You know, we've got this huge economy because of the military budgets. And something that I've read is the idea that this money that goes into producing weapons does not get channeled back into the economy the way it would for any other kind of product. I mean, if you're putting money into making cars, those cars are going to help people get somewhere and be able to do that kind of work. Whereas the money that goes into producing weapons all goes into this huge stockpile which grows and grows and grows and doesn't get used for any productive purpose. And
it is not labor intensive.
It doesn't create more jobs.
It doesn't create more jobs. It doesn't create more any more
or good
money shifting. There's no, nothing's happening with the economy. It just gets put in a pile.
You know, once you,
quick comment.
Once you have it in place, it's almost impossible to dismantle. And I think that's what Eisenhower was talking about when he warned us about that marriage between military and industry. Because nobody wants to vote to have his or her district lose jobs that are there,
right,
making money.
Even though the jobs aren't
right,
doing anything but just creating
volume. Okay. Here and then here.
And then here. Okay. In response to, are we on the right track? When we look at the trouble spots in the world, it seems like more and more the trouble spots are arising within what has always been the American sphere, where we have had the economic influence to control events. Central America, South America, below that, are the prime examples, where in Nicaragua we put Somoza in, who was a used car salesman in Pennsylvania before he was president of Nicaragua, and we thereby controlled that nation. We have controlled a large portion of the world by our economic influence and economic sphere. As a result, we have supported many, many, many governments that are unjust. And now we are forced into the uncomfortable position in all of these areas that we have to support the wrong side in order to keep things as they are. And if you look at the people, you look at the issue, you look at the oppression that's been going on from Iran with the Shah, which used to be our area of influence, to Central America and beyond, our military strength is not doing us any good. What happened to Iran? It certainly didn't go our way after pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars directly to the Shah to oppress people in Iran and build them a military. The only thing that's happened is their used debts have been used against Iraq now. Our approach has been to be on the wrong side. If we would start to assess foreign policy on the basis of justice as opposed to on the basis of how it's always been economically comfortable for us, the need for military weapons would be decreasing considerably. So that's one way we should change our tactics.
Okay. Before I call you, the another question, which it's interesting that it has not come up yet, how does the effect of that there's such a thing called nuclear weapons dramatically change or not change this whole argument? I might make your comment, whatever it might be.
The question about whether or not we're on the right track, I think, is the we is. I have to ask myself, am I on the right track?
Good point.
And then I ask, is the church on the right track? And I ask, finally, perhaps, if the nation is on the right track. But I think, I don't even know if I can influence what the nation does, but I'm going to try and continue to live what I see in the gospel, and I expect the church to do the same. And whether or not that's economically sound, or whether it's going to produce the most oil for us, or whatever the gain is, I think the message of the gospel and the call for us to live the gospel is primary before we even look at what the country that we just happen to be living in is doing.
John Tram, I remember, told the story about this little monk who was carrying this sign in Georgia or something during the civil rights days, and somebody came up and said, do you really think you're going to change the world by doing that? He said, oh no, I'm just trying to not have the world change me. You know, maybe that's one level of beginning. Yeah.
I'm encouraged in the last few years that the church is at least looking at these things. I can remember when the church was yay, rah, 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 my country right along. Mm-hmm. And when we're beginning to think about these things and think, are we right along? I think that's good. And it makes me feel a lot better.
And more patriotic, maybe, in that sense. That's it. Yeah.
I don't know. Well, just a little addition to that. Our senior pastor at our church has been scaring me lately with his sermons that is saying, yes, it is interesting that the church is getting more and more vocal about these issues, but what Fred said is that the more vocal we get, the more hostility we're going to receive from our very own government. And economic pressures will come to the fore long before we start getting too noisy about it, such as losing tax exempt status, etc. And we should just be aware that the first step to what Fred says, that maybe trying to live a corporate life with Christ, will probably get us into trouble.
It'll also make us more of a minority movement than we are.
Right. We'll give them.
Yeah. Up here and then down here, and we have about 4 minutes left, and we'll see what time it is after that.
I'm sensing that a majority of people, anyway, in this room are somewhat opposed to the move toward militarism in our society, and heard a lot of comments about living the way of the cross or the way of Jesus. I would just be interested in knowing how many people in this room have really thought about alternatives to militarism. My question is, how many people in this room have seriously studied those alternatives of nonviolence, civilian-based defense, those kinds of things, theory and practice of nonviolence, history of the Gandhi movement, all of those things? And I guess by study, I would say read more than one book. And I would just be interested in seeing a show of hands. How many have seriously studied theory and practice of nonviolence? And that's a few more hands than I asked this question a couple of years ago up here. And there were maybe two hands, and that's an encouraging sign that there are more, but I still think it's a comment on us as individuals and the church that we oppose militarism, but we still seriously have not changed our thinking in terms of educating ourselves in other alternatives. If that is our mandate, I would hope that we would all be serious about learning about nonviolence, because we have been educated all our lives on militarism, and we need to begin educating ourselves in nonviolence. And I would hope that we would all go back to our churches and ask for that. That be a part of our education from here on. Otherwise, there is going to be no change unless we know something else.
Just a footnote, if anybody wants to talk further with Tom, too, is a top resource here, being that the director of Lutheran Peace Fellowship on the national basis, so while besides being a piano player, so you might want to talk to him more about resources if you're interested in any of that. Yeah?
Make mine quick. But I think right now the church in the United States is a kept woman for the government. I think one of the first things we have to do is follow up on what you're saying. We have to surrender our tax-exempt status. We have to give that up. We must. We have to start paying taxes. We're going to have to start doing that, and then we'll have the freedom to talk.
Next, you'll attack the tax-free housing allowance for clergy.
I don't.
That's already going out the window.
Absolutely. I think we'll have to do that. Just a very quick example. During the summer, I was only taking a month where I just simply open it up. I give people a chance for a couple months at a time to write down things they'd like to have sermons on. I tell them that's a danger because I will give my point of view to whatever question it is. But we do that every summer. And last summer, I preached on, nobody asked for it, so I preached on it myself.
You stuff the only, you stuff the question.
You get a vote too.
That was nuclear weapons. I wanted to raise the whole question about nuclear weapons as to what it does and so on like that. And I thought it was really quite mamby-pamby about the whole thing. But anyway, we were right at that time in the business of starting a building remodeling project. And somebody dropped in a check that a week before, a fairly good-sized check for that project. And after that sermon, they went through the channels and stopped payment and did everything. I found myself really wondering about the whole thing because I had to talk to him. I did not want to recant what I had said because they thought I said far more than I said. I wanted to raise the question. But that's the type of thing you get into is, are you willing to put it, put your whole thing with it, even the new building model?
In conclusion, and like all forms, we never conclude. We only conclude kind of understanding the issue, so then we can try to struggle with it a lot further. One other practical thing we might be able to be involved with, besides our own style and our church's style, is our local high schools. I want to read one quote and make one brief comment on it. The Pentagon spends about $600 million a year for recruitment, including an advertising budget as big as that of some soap suds companies. Between 32,000 and 35,000 recruiters contact more than 300 high school seniors each. We in Albuquerque are looking at that, and we are demanding a group of peace groups to have equal time when they come and make their big pitches and things and just show other alternatives. And most students are saying, we never knew there were alternatives. And that's a very minimal way of doing that. There's some good resources for that, too. So with that in mind, Compton, I think, is there Compton tonight?
Yeah.
We'll be starting in 30 seconds or more. But a little stretch break, those who need to leave. Thank you so much.
Thank you.